So I've been talking about fairness in job scheduling for data centers. And this is joint work with three grad students, Matej Zaharia, Benjamin Hindman, and Andy Kamvinsky, and two professors, Scott Schenker and Jan Stoike. So I'll start with three slides giving a background on fair sharing. So if we consider this simple scenario where we have end users that want to share a common resource such as CPU, then the natural solution is to allocate each of these users one-nth of the shared resource. So in this example that we see here, we have a shared resource CPU, and each of the three users that want this resource get 33% of the shared resource. Now, this is generalized by max mean fairness, which handles the case when a user wants less than its fair share. So for example, if a user one wants no more than 20% of the shared resource, then the allocation will be as we see. So it gets 20% of the CPU, whereas the rest of the CPU is split evenly among the two other users. Now, max mean fairness itself is generalized further by weighted max mean fairness, which gives weights to users according to their importance. So for instance, if we give a weight of 1 to user 1, and we give a weight of 2 to user 2, then the allocation would be that the CPU, the first user would get 33% of the CPU, while the second user gets 66% of the CPU. So max mean fairness has two important properties that come almost for free. So the first one is the share guarantee, which means that each user can get at least one-nth of this common resource. But if she requires less, she will get less. And we saw that on the previous slide. The second property is that it's strategy proof, which means that users are not better off by asking for more than they need. So this means that users have no reason to lie. Okay. And it turns out that max mean fairness is the only reasonable mechanism that has these two properties. And when I say reasonable in quotes in the rest of the talk, I'm basically hiding some of the technical details that are not important. Okay, so why use max mean fairness? Why are people using this? So max mean fairness has two fundamental properties. One is that the fairness policy defines itself the isolation policy that the system has. So in other words, a user gets her fair share irrespective of the demands of other users. Just to emphasize this further, if we had no notion of fairness in the system at all, then how could we ever isolate the workload of two different users that are using a common resource? We would have to have some kind of notion of fairness where we say, okay, they each get 50% of this shared resource. The second fundamental property it has is that it provides a very flexible mechanism and then allows many different policies that can be implemented with this mechanism. So for instance, we have proportional sharing, whereby you can give users different weights depending on their demand. We can implement priority by setting the weights very far apart, so we give very high weights to some users, which would guarantee that if the user with the highest weight ever wants any resources, it would get all the resources. But if that user does not want any resources, then the second prioritized user would get all the resources. And we can also implement reservation with this. So if you want to, for instance, guarantee that some user gets at least 10% of the CPU resources, then we could give that user a weight of 10, and then always ensure that the sum of all the weights in the system is less than 100. So not surprisingly, max mean fairness have been used in many different contexts. So in networking, it's been used to implement weighted fair queuing and many other policies. In operating systems, it's been used to implement lottery scheduling. And in data centers, which is the case we care about, it's actually used by Hadoop's Fair Scheduler, by Hadoop's Capacity Scheduler, and Dryad's Quincy Scheduler. Okay, so we've established that it has all these nice properties, and many people are using it. So what's wrong with it? Why is max mean fairness not enough? Why do we have this talk? So job scheduling in data centers is not only about CPUs. So jobs consume CPUs, memory, disk, and I/O. So does this pose any problems for us, the fact that they're using all these resources? So if we look at this bubble graph, it shows the task demands in a 2000-node Hadoop cluster at Facebook from a one-month period last year. And the x-axis shows the memory demand of the tasks that are running in this cluster, and the y-axis shows the CPU demands of the tasks. And what we see here is that most of the tasks roughly need around 2 CPUs and 2 gigabytes of RAM on each machine. But we do also see that there are a number of tasks that are very memory intensive. They require 7 or 8 gigabytes of memory, but very little CPUs. And similarly, we have some tasks that are quite CPU intensive, but don't require that much memory. So we do indeed see that the resource demand in these clusters are heterogeneous. Okay, so let's look closer at how we would do scheduling for multiple resources in a data center. So if we take this simple problem that we have one resource CPU, and we have two users, and they want to run jobs that consist of many, many tasks, each task running on one machine. So if user one wants to run tasks each requiring one CPU, and user two wants to run tasks that require 3 CPUs per task, then assuming that these two users are equally important in our system, we would like our policy to split the CPU resource 50-50 between these two users. Okay. However, what happens if we consider two resources? So if we have CPU and memory, and now user one wants to run tasks that are dimensioned using one CPU and 4 gigabytes of RAM, whereas user two wants to run tasks that use 3 CPUs and 1 gigabyte of RAM per task. What is the fair allocation then? So this is the problem that we're concerned with in this talk. So to put it more concisely, the problem definition is, how do we fairly share multiple resources when users have heterogeneous demands on these? Okay. So the outline of the talk is as follows. Next, I'll go through the properties that we think are important for any fair scheduler that solves this problem of multi-resource fairness. Thereafter, I will show how we solve this problem with our policy called DRF, which satisfies those properties. After that, I'll look in the field of microeconomic theory and see how would they solve this problem. And finally, we'll see if does this work in practice, so we'll compare this with the current schedulers out there. Okay, so I'll start with a short model just to simplify the rest of the talk. So we assume here in this talk that users have tasks according to a demand vector. So for instance, if a user has task demand vector 2, 3, 1, it means that this user requires 2 units of the first resource, 3 units of the second resource, and 1 unit of the last resource. And I would like to emphasize that in practice, we don't actually need this. We don't need the demand vectors. What we use is that we actually measure the actual consumption of resources that users have in the system. But this will just simplify the reasoning in the rest of the talk. Furthermore, we assume that all these schedulers that we are considering, or these policies, always allocate resources in multiple of this demand vectors to the users. And finally, we assume divisible resources. So for instance, we ignore the case if you have a single port on a machine that you want to share for several applications. That would not be possible. We assume that you can always divide resources. Okay, so we looked at many different policies, and a very natural policy that we considered first is what we call asset fairness. So what asset fairness does is that it tries to equalize each user's sum of resource shares. Okay, so let's look at a simple example. So if we have a cluster with 70 CPUs and 70 gigabytes of RAM, and we have first user wants to use 2 CPUs and 2 gigabytes of RAM per task, and the second user wants to use 1 CPU and 2 gigabytes of RAM, then asset fairness would give the following allocation. So it would give the first user 15 tasks and the second user 20 tasks. So what it's done here is that the sum of the amount of CPU and memory that's given to the first user is 60, and which is equal to the sum of amount of resources given to the second user, which is 20 plus 40, which is also 60. Okay. However, the problem with this is that we see that user one now has got less than 50% of both of the resources. So this user is really better off by having its own cluster with 50% of all the resources. So this user is not really incentivized to pool resources in a common data center. And you might ask, does it make sense to add resources like this, CPU and memory? But if you weight the resources instead, so you have different importance weights for CPU and memory, you get into the same problem. So you, again, can end up with a user getting less than its fair share, or 1/n of all the resources in the system. So this leads us to our first fairness property, which is the share guarantee. Share guarantee is that every user should get at least 1/n of at least one resource. And the intuition behind this property is that you shouldn't be worse off than if you ran your own cluster with one-nth of the resources. And as we saw earlier in the talk in the beginning, this was trivially satisfied by max mean fairness for a single resource. Now, for the next property, we were influenced by our industrial partners. So they told us that users in these systems, in these data centers, are actually willing to game the system to get more resources. And they provided us with two actually anecdotes from real life. So the first one was a search company that provided a dedicated machine to its internal users if they could guarantee that they would always reach a certain level of utilization of those machines. So if they could have they could guarantee 80% utilization of those machines, they would get dedicated machines. So some users wanted that, and they gave them dedicated machines. But then they inspected the code that was running on these machines, and it turned out that the users had actually inflated their code by putting busy loops in there that would just do nothing just to get the utilization up. Okay? So these were employees of the same company. Another cloud provider was providing MapReduce cluster to external customers, and they had a quota on the number of map tasks and reduced tasks that could run in the cluster. So they found out that some user had discovered that the map quota was very low in the system. So what this user had done is that implemented basically all of the map phase in MapReduce inside of the reduce phase. So essentially doing everything inside the reduce phase, doing nothing in the map phase, so that they could get much more resources in the system than they would get if they would be implementing it using maps the normal way. Okay, so this leads us to the second property that we're considering, which is strategy proofness, which is that the user should not be able to decrease her allocation by lying about her demand vector about the different resources. So the intuition behind this is that users are incentivized to make truthful resource requirements. Okay. So the challenge that we have is that can we find a fair sharing policy that can provide these two? And note that both of these were trivially satisfied by max mean fairness for a single resource. Okay. So I'm now going to turn to our policy, DRF, which actually provides these two properties. And the next three slides are the most important. Those describe the DRF policy. So in DRF, there's a notion of a dominant resource, which is the resource that the user has the biggest share of. So if we look at the simple example, if we have total resources, 10 CPUs in the system and 4 gigabytes of memory, and we have a user that's been allocated 2 CPUs and 1 gigabyte of memory, then this user's dominant resource is memory, because it's been allocated 1/4 of the memory, but only 2/10 or 1/5 of the CPU resource. So along with this, we have the definition of a dominant share, which is simply just the fraction of the dominant resource that this user was allocated. Okay? So in this example, since it got 1/4 of its dominant resource, we say that the dominant share of this user is 25%. So what max mean fairness does, what DRF does is that it applies max mean fairness to these dominant shares. So the intuition is that it tries to equalize the dominant share of these different users. So if we look at a simple example, and this example I'll use throughout the talk, so it could be good to remember it. We have, in this example, 9 CPUs in the whole cluster and 18 gigabytes of RAM in the whole cluster. And user 1 has a demand of 1 CPU and 4 gigabytes of memory per task, and user 2 has a demand of 3 CPUs and 1 gigabyte of memory per task. And if you do the arithmetic, it turns out that the first user's dominant resource is actually memory, whereas the second user's dominant resource is CPU. Then DRF would give the following allocation. So we see that the first user has been given three tasks, and the second user has been allocated 2 tasks, which means that the first user has gotten 12 gigabytes of RAM, which corresponds to 66% of all the memory resources in the whole system. And the second user has gotten 6 CPUs, which corresponds to also 66% of all the CPU resources in the system. So what DRF has done is it's equalized their dominant shares. Okay? So in clusters, in data centers, we seldom face this problem that you get a completely empty cluster and you have to come up with the allocation for these. So what happens in these clusters typically is that you have a dynamic scenario where you have tasks finishing, jobs coming in, and resources freeing up. So how we actually implement this in an online scheduler is that whenever there are available resources and tasks to run, we will schedule a task to the user with the smallest dominant share. So this is a very simple way to implement this. And this is actually how it was implemented in Mesos. And you heard a talk about that earlier this morning by Matei. And it turns out that you can do this quite efficiently. So you can implement this with log n operations per decision, where n is the number of users. And the way you do it is you just use a binary heap and keep track of all the dominant shares of the users. And each time you need to schedule, you pick the user with the least dominant share. All right, so next, let's turn to how an economist would solve this. So it turns out in the field of economics, they've dealt with this resource allocation problems for many, many years. So why not just use pricing? This is a natural thing. And the approach would be to set prices for each of these goods or resources, and then let users buy whatever resources they want. And they could buy it either using funny money, or they could actually be using real money. The challenge, however, is, how do we determine the right prices for these goods? Okay? So how would an economist do this? So an economist would say we should let the market determine these prices. So there is a policy that does this, and it's called Competitive Equilibrium from Equal Incomes from 1974. And the way it works is that you say that you split all the resources up into n pieces, and you give each user 1/n of every resource. And then you let these users trade in a perfectly competitive market. However, it turns out that this policy is not strategy-proof, as I will show next. So the reason I'm, just to give a background, the reason I'm looking at CWEI is that it's the main preferred method in microeconomic theory or in cooperative game theory. Okay. So let's look at this example of why it's not strategy-proof. So if we have the same example as before, user 1 wants 1 and 4 resources, and user 2 wants 3 and 1 resources, we see the following allocations. So the DRF allocation I already showed you earlier. So the users both get 66% of their dominant resource. However, CWI, what it will do is it will give an allocation where the first user gets 91% of its dominant resource, and the second user gets 55% of its dominant resource. So in essence, what we're seeing is that in some sense, DRF is more fair here, whereas CWI is giving better utilization. So this is not so weird, because when you have a perfectly competitive market, you have this assumption of what they call market clearance, which is that supply should always meet demand. So it's natural that it tries to maximize the utilization of the system. So we see here that the CWI allocation, all the resources are utilized, 100%. Okay. So let's look at what happens if user 2 now decides to lie. So user 2 changes its demand for the second resource, which is 1 gigabyte of memory, and inflates it to 2 gigabytes of memory, and you know, uses more resources or tells the system it wants to use more resources. So on the right now, we see the allocations that DRF and CWI would give. And what we see here is that in the case of CWI, user 2, who lied about its demands, increased its share now of its dominant resource to 60% from 55, which means that it can actually run more tasks in the system now by lying about its resource demands. In the case of DRF, however, it remains 66%. Okay. So one can ask, how come? Why is CWI not strategy-proof? And the next example more or less implies that whenever you're having a scheduler that tries to optimize utilization, it can always be gamed. Okay? So let's look at this very simple example. If we have a cluster with 100 CPUs and 100 gigabytes of memory, and we have two users that have identical demands in the system, they both want to run tasks that use 1 CPU and 2 gigabytes of memory. Now, since they have symmetric requirements, they exactly want the same thing, the only natural thing to do for a policy is to say that, okay, we'll split the CPU 50-50 between these two users and then give them 25% of the CPU. Sorry, the memory 50-50. Okay? What happens now, however, if user 1 decides to lie and say, no, I actually need 2 CPUs and 2 gigabytes of memory for each of my tasks? So what we see is that any scheduler that tries to optimize utilization would now prefer user 1. Right? If it wants to decrease the utilization in the system. For instance, if it gave this allocation, where it's given 95% of the resources to the first user, utilization has gone up from 50% up to a much higher number. Okay. So we looked at many other properties also, and I will not mention them. They're in the paper if you're interested. But the most important thing in this table is that if you look at the first two lines, we have the share guarantee and the strategy proofness. And what we see is that CWI only satisfies one of these, and the same is also true for asset fairness. So the RF is the only one that satisfies both those properties. And in the bottom of the table, you can see that there is one property that none of these satisfy. I haven't talked to you about this property, but I can just say that we can actually prove that if you want to satisfy all those properties that the RF satisfies, then it's impossible to satisfy the last one in the list. Okay, so how well does this work actually in practice? So our evaluation methodology was as follows. So we first ran two micro-experiments on EC2 to see how DRF behaves in the small. And what we did here is, first, we have an experiment that we ran, which evaluates DRF's dynamic behavior when demands are changing. So it just looks at DRF. Second, we wanted to compare DRF with the current Hadoop scheduler. So we ran an experiment that compares the performance of the two. And then finally, we had a micro-benchmark that evaluates how DRF works in the large scale. So what we did here is that we simulated Facebook traces with DRF and the current scheduler. So let's start with the first micro-experiment that just looks at DRF. So what we have here is that we had two users running in an EC2 cluster of 48 nodes of extra large instances. And what these users would do is that every 100 seconds, they would pick a random demand vector. Okay? And in the first top graph, we see that the shares of the two resources that user one has gotten over time. In the second graph, we see the shares of the second user over time. And the third graph in the bottom shows the dominant shares of both users over time. So the main thing that we see is that the intuition that I gave before, you can see it in the bottom graph. So we see that the dominant shares of the users are equalized at all times. What's more interesting, if we look at the first 100 seconds of this experiment, we see that the first user is requiring most, its dominant resource is memory. So that's what it wants share-wise most of. And the second user's dominant resource is CPU. So these requirements dovetail. So what we see is that the dominant share in the bottom graph is much higher than 50% for both of them. Both of them are getting 70% of their dominant resource. So this really demonstrates the share guarantee that we had earlier, that each user gets at least one nth of its resources. After 100 seconds, however, we see that the first user's demand changes and its dominant resource also becomes CPU, in which case they both are constrained on the same resource, so dominant shares drop down to 0.5. Okay. So the next experiment I mentioned was the one where we want to compare with the current schedulers. So how do the current schedulers work today, or the current Hadoop Fair scheduler or capacity scheduler work today? So the way they work is that they will say that each machine consists of k slots. And then they will say that we'll run at most one task per slot on each of these machines. So in the case of the Facebook cluster, k was equal to 14. So it means at any given time, there are at most 14 tasks running on any given machine. Then the fair scheduler here will try to give jobs equal number of slots. So in other words, it's applying max mean fairness to this slot count. Okay? So this is what we will compare with in the in the next slide. So what we did here is that we ran two different types of jobs. We see at the bottom the demands that they had. So the first job had required 2 CPUs and 2 gigabytes of memory per task, and the second job required 1 CPU and half a gigabyte of memory per task. And what we see is that the two graphs, they compare DRF on the left with slot fairness, so the current Hadoop scheduler, for different number of slots per machine. So it's different experiments looking at k equals 3 or k equals 4 and so on. And what we're looking at is how many jobs finished in a 15-minute interval. So we ran the experiment for 15 minutes and then compared how many jobs finished in these of type 1 and of type 2. So it's the same experiment. So what we can see immediately is that DRF, we have more jobs finished than all the other configurations of slot fairness. So this is not that surprising, maybe, because when you only have 3 or 4 slots per machine, you really have a very low utilization on these machines. You're basically capping and saying you can only run 3 or 4 tasks per machine. So not that many jobs finished due to this low utilization. However, a little bit more surprising is that when you have many slots per machine, you're basically overutilizing this machine. So you're having so many tasks running on each machine. So what ends up happening is that you use so much memory that the operating system starts swapping to this, then you have thrashing. So you get even poorer performance. So we see the similar thing. So this is the same experiment now. But here instead, we look at job completion time for the same setup, same thing. And we see again the same thing, that DRF jobs complete faster than the ones that are using slot fairness. And we have the same phenomena. So we see that those that are using three slots, the job completion time is much longer. Well, it's because we have very low utilization in these clusters. And we have low utilization, well, it will take longer for these tasks to get launched and finish. And similarly, performance gets really poor when you have a lot of tasks on each machine and they're using much more resources than maybe is available on each machine. Okay. And then finally, we wanted to see how DRF performs in the large. So what we did is we did the simulations of 1 month, actually 1 week, Facebook traces from October last year. And what these simulations did is they implemented DRF, ran the whole trace, and recorded all the job completion times for each job, and then re-ran the same simulation again, but for slot fairness, for the number of slots that they actually had in the Facebook cluster. And so what we see in this graph is, on the y-axis we have the reduction in completion time for the different jobs, and on the x-axis we have different job sizes. So what we see clearly is that for jobs that consist of more than 500 tasks, the completion time reduces from 35% up to 50-60%. However, for the jobs that are very small and consist of very few tasks, we don't see any big difference. And the reason for that is, if a job only consists of 2-3 tasks, then it's not going to be affected that much by the higher levels of utilization that we get, because it gets launched immediately, it runs in one wave, and job completion time equals the time that the longest task takes to execute. Okay, so that concludes. So in conclusion, the main takeaway from this talk is that DRF provides multiple resource fairness in the presence of heterogeneous demands. And it's the first generalization of max mean fairness to multiple resources. And it has the following desirable properties. So it guarantees the share guarantee property always, which is that every user at least always gets 1nth of one resource. It's also strategy proof, which means that lying can only hurt you in the system. And finally, it performs better than the current approaches that we saw in the evaluation. And before I end, I'd just like to state this conjecture that we have, which is that we think that DRF is the only reasonable policy that satisfies these two properties. So given these two properties, DRF is the only policy. So the two properties are strategy proofness and share guarantee. And there is an economist at Berkeley right now, Eric Friedman, that is working on trying to prove this. And he's proved it for the case of 2 users and 3 users, but he's having a hard time to do it for n users. It gets very complicated. Okay, so with that, I'd like to conclude. Thank you.
Derek Murray, University of Cambridge. So you talked a lot about CPU and memory. But in a map-reduced cluster, isn't the bottleneck resource going to be disk in a map task and network in a reduced task?
So we don't have access to that data, so I don't actually know where the bottleneck is. All we can see is that, so I don't have the graphs for that here, but certainly if you just look at CPU and memory, you definitely see that the slot fairness that they're using, occasionally they'll fill up the amount of memory in the cluster completely, or more often CPU. So.
Sure, but would that not have some impact on the duration of the tasks, depending on how you collocate them?
Yes, yeah, it's possible. So the only way to find this out would be to run DRF in a large scale and see how it works. And I would definitely be interested in doing that.
Okay, thanks. Okay,
thanks. So this is Changbing from UPenn. So I saw your comparison between two strategies, between a DRF and a CWEL. Uh-huh. So for the CWEL, you claim that it's not strategy proof because you say that customers may lie about their demands to get more resources, right? So, but this is an assumption that the customers say that they want to get more resources because they are willing to pay more, right? So if they get more resources, they have to pay more. So this will constrain that they are going to lie. So how are you deal with this?
So what is exactly the question?
Because CEL is like the, suppose you have a perfectly competitive market. Everybody just claim how much they want,
right.
And they have to pay if they get resources, right? This is going to constrain that they're going to lie, so...
Right? Okay. Yeah, so I didn't really cover this. So CII, I mean, the way you would implement it in a system, so it's possible you could do it with a complicated scheme where people actually pay money, but the way you actually do it, or what they do in macroeconomic theory, is that there is this theorem from the 80s that shows that basically... how you can actually calculate this analytically. So you don't need to have users. So there is, given a certain model, it turns out the Nash bargaining solution actually gives the CWEI solution.
Yeah, and the CWEI also turned out to have more efficiency than the DRF, which attempts to maximize the fairness. So in economics, there is always a trade-off between efficiency and the fairness.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah.
And if you think that you don't care about strategy proofness, you're okay with everyone just inflating their demands, then maybe CWI is the right way to go.
Okay.
And you prefer utilization. Yeah.
Okay, thanks.
Mike Friedman, I actually have a Princeton. I have a follow-up question to that. I mean, you kind of joked about people paying resources, but certainly that happens on the spot market on Amazon. So I was wondering if instead of paying exact, you employed some type of VCG mechanism that is supposed to be strategy proof. So I'm kind of wondered if, I mean, you don't only have to pay exactly the one you asked for, but you could actually design the exchange to try to bring, make the mechanism strategy proof. So I was wondering if you've looked at that at all or thought about that?
No, I mean, we haven't looked at that. So the thing you would have to have is then you would have a market for each of the resources, right? Is that what you're saying? And then they would have to bid for each of the resources to determine the
You could. It just seemed a fairly bold... I mean, you were giving a trade-off between utilization and fairness, and it just seemed a fairly bold claim that saying that economic theory couldn't make anything strategy-proof.
That economic theory... Sorry.
Couldn't make something strategy-proof.
So if you don't use a real market, the analytical way to calculate these, the only way to do it, we think, is this, if you want to have strategy proofness. I don't think you can get it with any of the other mechanisms.
Sure, thanks.
But yeah, thanks.
So since it is actually the break, I'm going to do something strange, which is don't leave. People who are waiting in line are welcome to keep pestering the speaker, but I want to encourage anybody who's stressed about needing to check out to feel free to leave at this time. So let's thank the speaker and then continue haranguing him with interesting questions.